Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. Today we're marrying the drama of the runway with that of the cinema as we take a look at McQueen, the new documentary about the late fashion designer Alexander McQueen. Joining me in the studio today are the film critic Anna Smith and film critic for the Daily Telegraph, Tim Robey, and we'll be seeing if this documentary does justice to the rags-to-riches story of one of the most beloved modern fashion designers.
The original documentary on Alexander McQueen, the McQueen tapes.
Lee Alexander McQueen was born in the late 1960s in East London. The designer was interested in clothes from a young age, and as soon as he left school, quickly rose through the ranks, starting on Savile Row and passing through various fashion houses, from costume designers to Givenchy. He was known for his impeccable tailoring, a unique creative vision, his outspoken nature, wicked sense of humour and drive to succeed, a combination which quickly drew the fashion elite to his talent.
His clothes have all this slashing and sex and romance.
And the darkness created genius.
But as is often the case, talent doesn't come without a cost. Depression, drugs, issues with his self-image. He began his line Alexander McQueen in 1992 after completing a much-lauded collection as part of his Central St. Martin's Master's course. He designed for Bowie, Björk, and his muse and supporter, the editor Isabella Blow, and of course, a wealth of other models and couture clients, securing his place as a key figure in fashion. He was awarded prizes aplenty, as well as the CBE. But his success was to be short-lived, as McQueen sadly committed suicide in 2010, aged just 40. His life is now being explored in a new film called simply McQueen.
He was a sweet boy from the East End.
I wasn't very good at school. I was always drawing clothes in science, in biology.
He has got nothing, and yet he was determined this is what he was going to do.
I bought all my fabrics with my doll money.
And what was that East End job used as a needle?
People in the industry say, oh, I discovered Alexander McQueen. Alexander McQueen discovered himself.
Anna and Tim, welcome to the programme. Some fertile ground to discuss and discover, I suppose, with McQueen. Anna, I'll start with you. Let's talk about the structure of the film. It kind of starts with his CV, as it were. And there's this kind of clever thing they do with the skull, which became the logo for his fashion brand. And then they sort of end with the tapes section, which is people kind of waxing lyrical about him. Tell us how it sort of hangs together as a documentary and what sort of documentary it is.
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways they could have told his story. They could have gone for a more sensationalist angle. I think they could have had different talking heads. I mean, when you think about all the different people that could talk about one person, it's a very specific sort of selection. Yeah. What I liked about this is they decided to tell it primarily through several of his key fashion shows, so runway shows, and they talked about how those reflected his personality, his life, and that was quite an elegant way of weaving in commentary from members of his family and his friends and his colleagues who talked about the motivations behind key aspects of his work and that sort of flamboyant theatrical element that he had and the demons that he had, which of course led to his demise. So I think it wasn't necessarily the most sensational way of telling the story, but I think that structure was quite clever because it allowed for a lot of different elements to come into play and it was very well edited.
And when we're talking about someone so creative and we're making a film about them, I'm always slightly, it's a tough thing to do, to make a film about another thing is tough. It reminds me of the Elvis Costello thing about, you know, you
dancing
can't dance
about
architecture, right?
Yeah.
How do you make a film about something else? Tim, how did they get over that hurdle?
Yeah, I mean, for the fashion world especially, it can feel like a bit of a closed circuit, I feel. Mm. And the danger would be it being a kind of insidery love-in. In which we feel a bit excluded. I actually think it strikes a really good balance because they've got enough access. Clearly, these guys know that world pretty well, but they also have enough objectivity to be able to stand outside it a little bit and kind of assess it from in a wider way. Also, they have flair as directors and as editors, as Anna mentioned. The film has some real pizzazz to it. It's not just your kind of workaday, TV doc. It's actually got some real colour and kind of liveliness in the approach. They've borrowed ideas from his designs in terms of sculpting the film, the skull that you mentioned at the beginning, for instance. And they generally sort of want to live up to his kind of aesthetic, his flamboyance, as much as they can through the filmmaking and, as we're going to later discuss, through the music.
Yeah, because it's a funny thing. There are moments when it's very operatic. And, of course, if you're just simply playing on a big screen, some shots, some of the footage that was shot from his runway shows, even just doing some last-minute stitches on the models and on those amazing clothes, on those amazing gowns, it can't be anything but operatic. And they kind of go for that, and they don't go exactly hook, line, and sinker, but hook and line and sink. Maybe not kitchen sink, I don't know. You can't do a film about McQueen without kind of whooshing along at the speed of McQueen, I suppose. You mentioned, Tim, the guys that made it. That's Peter Etedjui and Ian Bonnot. What is their form?
Well, they're not names that I know particularly well at all. I mean, they've got some form in documentaries, but I think they're really kind of fashion guys with some filmmaking clout. Anna can probably fill me in a bit more on what they've...
Well, yeah, Etedjui's father founded Joseph.
Yes,
yeah. Fashion
I thought,
brand.
This is, yeah. I thought that's too rare a surname to have too many of in the fashion world.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that the Marlon Brando documentary as
that's
well
right.
he
they
was
did
involved
the,
with, which was really
listen,
good.
Listen to Me, Marlon, which was a very singular documentary, actually, in terms of its structure and kind of using Marlon's own voice back from the grave, as it were. And there's a little bit of that in here with the tapes. They've got kind of quite privileged access to kind of very early footage of McQueen at work. Kind of practically speaking to us and kind of filling us in. I think the combination of those two things is what is necessary for the film. The fashion, the kind of insidery access plus the filmmaking kind of dynamism, and they've got both.
Just a side note on the idea of, you mentioned, Tim, fashion as a sort of bit of an inside story all the time. This film is good in the sense that we get a sense of how important he was, how important his talent was to big businesses. And it didn't go down the kind of, as you say, the kind of TV documentary thing of kind of going, aren't these people weird and they work in fashion and what, look at their habits and look at what they're... It kind of presumes that you are of the opinion that fashion is an important thing. It is often an art form. It is definitely a craft and it makes a lot of money. Is that, do you think that, Anna, that people need to be sort of whacked over the head with that rolled up newspaper or that rolled up copy of Vogue, I wonder?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's sort of preaching to the converted in a good way because, you know, there is a huge appetite for fashion documentaries now, and most people going there will have some context and some knowledge of McQueen, so it doesn't necessarily need to be sort of freak show. I mean, yeah, it could have gone down that route. I'm sure there's lots more eccentric and crazy anecdotes that people could have told, but it's not really that really kind of point and stare stuff. It's quite reverent, you know. It touches on some scandalous stuff, but it's quite reverent, and I like that about it.
It loves his flair and interest in scandal. It revels in that.
Yeah,
his desire to kind of make a splash with everything he was doing, and him kind of fretting over what can I do with this cellophane in my studio. Okay, I'll just wrap it around someone and send them out. You know, let's just do it. Just some safety pins and stuff.
There's something weirdly operatic yet make do and mend about everything he does.
I love that. And it's also funny. And it also reminds me of Zoolander. It reminds me that Mugatu in Zoolander is not a million miles away from what the fashion world is actually doing a lot of the time.
Yeah, there's a little bit of Bruno.
A bit of Bruno, a bit of Mugatu.
Exactly. Yes, it has been covered in film.
Derelict is definitely a show. I can imagine Alexander McQueen putting out there.
Yeah, and it leaves that you mentioned excess, Anna, and it sort of mentions that, and it mentions some of the seeds of his demise, obviously, as it has to do, but it leaves most of that to what goes into his creativity and the collections. And some things were controversial, obviously, his Rape of the Highlands, what was it called?
The Highland Rape
Highland
Collection.
Yeah,
which I think possibly might be even more controversial now, but naturally it grabbed headlines then. And he definitely was out to shock, but this quite delicately looks at some of the reasons that he may have been obsessed with sexual violence and look back into things in his past. Sort of touches on that, but at the same time it's not sort of apologising for the fact that in some ways, you know, to many people that show was very offensive, but it also says, well, this is a man that understood fashion's need for drama and to get attention, to get headlines. I mean, personally, I kind of would have liked to have seen a little bit more about the actual couture Dior and the actual fashions,
yeah.
but in the ones that people wore, you know, because he did make amazing tailoring. But at the same time, what made him famous were these extreme shows with hugely controversial subject matters, which were dazzling sometimes in a quite scary way. So I think that's what they're focusing on, more on the wearable collections.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff reminded me in the way that in the content of it and the creativity of the designer and in the way it was covered. There's a really good documentary, I don't know if you've seen it, about Franca Sozzani, the late editor of Italian Vogue, who's amazing. And she put these editorials together, these fashion shoots, and styled them that were, it was sort of McQueen-esque, kind of before McQueen was doing it. And she took on all sorts of issues like domestic violence and climate change and all these sorts of things, and made controversial points in her none too fashion magazine, the ultimate fashion magazine, I suppose, Italian Vogue. And there was kind of a lot of that. I kind of felt there was a lot of that in it, kind of saying that fashion can make statements about the world. Where do we sit on that? Do we step outside of the film for a second?
Yeah, I believe that is the case. And this film reminds me that when someone that singular comes through, they are capable of really shaking things up and doing something original. And I feel as though the level of shock and kind of scandal, if you like, that his shows promoted or kind of threw up is actually quite rare these days. You find me a Highland Rape collection now, which is going to get front pages of the tabloids going, what is this sick nonsense? It just doesn't happen. And regardless of where you stand on that particular show, I think he made that impact. And he made it while remaining kind of quite a real person. That's what this film also reminds you, that he just, in interviews, he's surprisingly unguarded. He doesn't disappear into that sort of Svengali sort of I must not say anything because I am a fashion god now, yeah, thing mode, which so many people do. Even though you see him slimming down and becoming very kind of self-conscious about his look.
He doesn't change his accent.
He doesn't change his accent. Yeah, yeah. And that kind of stuff. And I think that's what makes the end of his story very sad, is that he's still that real person right at the end and very lonely.
Nobody could create emotion like McQueen.
If you leave without emotion, then I'm not doing my job properly. I don't want you to walk out feeling like you've just had Sunday lunch. I want you to be repulsed or exhilarated. As long as it's an emotion.
His garments, they're almost confessional.
In my work, everything I do is personal, even turning Kate Moss into a hologram.
He's such a great protagonist for a film, isn't he? I mean, he's so good. And I've read this in a few reviews, in fact, of this documentary, that people said, oh, it shouldn't have been Tom Ford. Or Tom Ford's fine, but we kind of wish Lee McQueen had sat behind the lens. Do you see any of that, Anna, or is that kind of a nice sort of trick of the reviewer to say that?
Well, that he could have gone. He could have gone
and made feature films.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he certainly had that eye and that sense of drama and what gets people's attention and what gets people talking. Absolutely. And he is a fascinating protagonist because, of course, it's a rags to riches story. And probably one of my favourite parts of the film is the early part of the film where you find, you know, that the son of a cabbie with all his brothers and sisters and all he was obsessed with growing up was clothes. And it's an extraordinary idea of someone just being born into it and just having that passion from the word go. And then that inspiring element of how he just knocked on several old doors and got work and insisted and just proved himself with his talent. So that, to me, is the most extraordinary part of the film when you find out more about that man.
And the era, right? I mean, that was the time when I was growing up and getting my first jobs and things as well. And it depicts the 90s quite well, the hedonism, the creativity, the fact that a lot of people, whether they were bands or what became the YBAs or fashion designers, were on the dole while they were making their sort of key early work, or certainly their sort of first post college work. Right?
Totally, yeah.
Does that well.
Throwing yourself into your work and life all in one go, and with that kind of Barrow Boy mentality that he had a bit, I think he really didn't like being thought of as kind of this fashion yob later on after he'd made his success. But he clearly was just so obsessive and devoted to it. And like you say, the kind of similar movements in music at the time and stuff. And managing to land the job as head of Givenchy at 27. Extraordinary. And he thought, I mean, that's an Icarus sort of trajectory.
Yeah.
And he hated his first work for them and kind of is very self-critical as well, which is another part of his appeal. He wasn't one to sort of just like PR puff everything he was doing. He sort of thought that was a failure. But then he comes back with more and more interesting work. I think he's a much more interesting designer than Tom Ford. I don't like Tom Ford's clothes. I don't like his films either.
So. So I quite like his films. He claims the Dallas Ditchwater.
Yeah.
I mean, you might say. Yeah. I mean, do you know what I mean? There's no cut.
Well, I think his films are almost compensating too much. They're like, I'm really flamboyant and my aesthetic is quite camp, in fact, but no.
I would disagree, but there you go.
Yeah. and as we said kind of at the beginning, audiences are primed now for a sort of major league fashion documentary about a major league figure, obviously, in this case. I know one of the things that you want to talk about, maybe in a couple of minutes, is the Diana Vreeland documentary. And I think that was made by the same young guy that made Dior and I. But there's a lot of stuff out at the moment. There's a Vivienne Westwood one, which I think is also a Dogworth production, which is like this one. So there's a lot of stuff. What are the sort of strands that these things pull together? There's the first Monday in May, I suppose. There's the September issue.
September
there are all
issue,
these
yeah.
things. The first, these are all these things.
Well, there's also, I think this also sits in the same tradition as the music documentaries about the kind of tragic divas, the Whitney and Amy that we've had, you know. And in fact, there's an interesting parallel with the Whitney documentary that we just had, Kevin McDonald's one, in terms of childhood sex abuse being a sort of key to the mystery, if you like, which this film sort of slightly hints it was.
Yeah.
But who doesn't love a good fashion documentary when it's made by people with an eye themselves? That's the thing.
My favourite might be the Bill Cunningham one. Have you both seen that?
Absolutely.
It's so tender.
Absolutely brilliant.
And he's such a kind of, for such a shy man, he's such a great protagonist to follow around. So simple, just with his little camera and his kind of uniform and living in his little loft in Soho still in New York. There's something kind of very beguiling about him as well. Very chalk and cheese characters, Lee McQueen and Bill Cunningham. But there's obviously a line linking these two things together about an eye for beauty, I suppose.
Definitely. Again, the idea of someone who was an unlikely candidate for his job, but he just was born into it and passionate about it and determined to do it. And they're actually doing a new Bill Cunningham documentary soon as well, narrated by Sarah Jessica Parker, I think. So more on him would be great.
Yeah, wouldn't it be?
I
love him. Power,
it's great.
Power to Cunningham. it's time for our extra reading section. Yeah,
but I thought you were bringing in some kind of little jingle.
I think maybe
just have a little noise.
Maybe as this show kind of reaches into its comfort zone and sits back in its Chesterfield armchair, there will be a bed underneath this bit. But you wanted to talk about the music of Michael Nyman, Tim, which was used by McQueen in at least one of his shows, especially commissions and music.
Yeah,
tell us how you thought of this.
Well, one thing I didn't know about him is that he was obsessed with Michael Nyman. And
was he?
In the early 90s, when he was kind of beavering away in his loft getting his early shows together, he would just, as the film tells us, he would just be playing the piano soundtrack on repeat. Michael Nyman's most famous score. And I think because of this and because of him using music subsequently, Michael Nyman has basically agreed to score this entire film using excerpts from all of his work. And it's a really, as well as being a fascinating film about McQueen, I found it a fascinating Michael Nyman retrospective as well, because you're hearing fragments from not only the piano, but things like Gattaca, the Goth, Drossman's Contract, his early Peter Greenaway films, and then later stuff like Wonderland, the Michael Winterbottom film, a whole range of them being used. And those kind of like rhythms that Michael Nyman's music has, that kind of, there's an obsessiveness to them, that kind of like circularity, and it just really suits the business of putting clothes together, I think, and the kind of what's going on in the designer's head. It's just a perfect match of music and material. So I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the whole experience from a sonic level too.
Let's remind ourselves of how beautiful the piano soundtrack was. Yeah, there's something in there where you can't quite decide whether it's euphoric or deeply melancholic.
I used to be able to play it. I just had such flashbacks to like the 1995, just kind of like working away on that score and like sort of piano bed sits at school and stuff. And I love that. I love that score greatly. It's unbelievable. It didn't get even an Oscar nomination. That music.
Did it not?
Nope.
He didn't. Back
even,
in the day,
didn't even get nominated. Yeah. So Holly Hunter wins Best Actress. He didn't get nominated. But
that's been re-released, hasn't it? Recently.
Because it's 25th anniversary.
I love
need to go
film.
And make a date for it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, how rare is it also for a documentary to have its own? We've talked about Amy Winehouse, Whitney Houston documentaries and things like that. Obviously, we know where the music's going to come from. But for something like this is a pretty much a one-off, isn't it? To have such a high-profile composer make music for a documentary, or license, rather, his music.
Yeah, sort of like in-house composer Michael Nyman.
Not bad, is it?
It's pretty good. They must have been quite happy when they scored that, I think, as well. Those two directors. Because it does actually... It keeps the whole film kind of bobbing along, actually. Sometimes you might find there are longers, or you're moving from one show to the next, and one of them would be less interesting. There could be lulls. But I think the music's always there to kind of keep momentum up. I just love rediscovering some of those scores. Gattaca is another brilliant one as well. Yeah,
yeah, it's wonderful. Anna, you wanted to talk about, we mentioned it just before, the Vreeland documentary about, she was the first ever editor of Vogue, was she not? US Vogue?
Fashion editor, yeah. I mean, yeah. She was an absolutely extraordinary woman. She was just one of those persons with such an incredible vision, an absolute strength of belief in her own opinion. And this is a lovely documentary that puts together great archive footage and examples of the fashion shoots that she did, which, like McQueen, were very extraordinary and really, really pushing the boundaries. And we've got a wonderful narration from herself from an interview that she did. And I think that's probably where it's got the edge on McQueen, because there's
such a good voice.
Yeah, an incredible voice. I won't do an impression, but it's an amazing voice. She sounds like a sort of film actor, or a real character. Yeah. And she was really, really forthright. She had a lot to say. And everyone who talks about her has funny stories about how, you know, she threw things at them and she just spent loads of money on fashion shoots. She didn't have much money, but she spent money and she made people look beautiful. And there's extraordinary stories about how she grew up with her mother told her how pretty her sister was and how ugly she was, and how that marked her, but then how maybe that motivated her.
Yeah.
And again, it's a story of someone's childhood which has shaped them and driven them to be extreme and extremely successful and kind of obsessed with beauty.
We can do impersonations of the wonderful Diana Vreeland after we've listened to this clip, perhaps.
I wasn't a fashion editor. I was the one and only fashion editor.
She saw things in people before they saw it themselves.
She celebrated Barbra Streisand's nose. She would say, push their faults, make it the most beautiful thing about them.
Diana was just so far ahead. I mean, it wasn't just about fashion. It was about art. It was about music. And it was a society. It was all woven together.
It's wonderful stuff. I want someone to turn that into a film.
Well, Edna Mode in The Incredibles is already halfway to Diana Vreeland.
I suppose so. Now, you wanted Catherine Hepburn to play Diana Vreeland, really. That would be the one, wouldn't it? That's kind of where you're going. And yeah, Frederick Cheng, I think, was the third name on the director's list for that. And he went on then to do Dior and I. So the Westwood film is out. I think it's out still out in cinemas now, which is pretty good. I think Not Without a Struggle was that one made. But it's kind of a wonderful piece of work and a fascinating one. I think also in talking about Vogue, they're doing one about André Léon Talley, aren't they? Which will be kind of interesting, kind of where he came from, how he kind of has it sort of inserted himself as a great kind of demented magus of the kind of current setup at US Vogue as well. So fashion is kind of fertile ground. I hope we've kind of covered it. It's been decent stuff, hasn't it? That brings us to the end of today's show. We should say, go to the cinema and watch this. And what I found was then I went on Netflix. Other online film providers are available. Team, and then just kind of devoured everything that was kind of like you might also like, because they're so good. Once you get into that vibe, you just want to see how these things, amazing things, are made. There's a great book as well called Devils and Monsters by Dana Thomas, an American fashion journalist, about the rise and fall of Galliano and McQueen, which is kind of really amazing as well. That was my extra reading bit. But no bed for me, no soundtrack for my bit.
who would be your ideal in-house composer?
Who'd be my in-house composer?
Demand one, yeah.
It'd be Tony Banks from Genesis.
There we go.
Come on. McQueen is showing at cinemas now. Thank you very much to my guests, Anna Smith and Tim Roby, and of course my producer, Holly Fisher. Thanks to Fernanda Augusto Pacheco. And we'll be back at the same time next week, but for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.